PathProjects.com. Scott, they entered the market in the summer 2017, but you'd think it was longer because they're ever present. They're always on my mind.
They are, and it's starting to get a little bit cooler. We had our first rain just recently here in Northern California, and I broke out my three-quarter length shirt. It's kind of like that baseball shirt length.
Right, right. Three-quarter jersey.
Jersey, is that what it's called?
I don't know.
But I forgot I even had it. I thought, hey, it's like putting on your favorite shirt for the first time.
When you misplace something and you pull it out and you go, ah, where has this been?
Yeah.
That one. Well, there's a reason, Scott. It's because the materials that they use, it's the care and the craftsmanship put into each one of these. And the only place to buy it is not in your local running store. Not at this time. It is directly through Path, and you get fantastic pricing and value when you order from them.
That's the reason they did that distribution model. You could go to pathprojects.com.
Trex Air. When I say Trex Air, Scott, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
The name brand, Aftershocks.
Aftershocks. I think great sound, and I'm still open to the environment. I can still hear because it's bone conduction technology.
You know, I just got an Apple Series 4 watch, yes. And I've paired my Trex Airs to my Apple 4 watch, and I use it for taking calls now.
I do not, and I fear sometimes being a headphone guy. I don't want to be the guy running down the trail and oblivious to four people behind me saying, excuse me, on your left, can I get by? And I'm just bopping away to my music. That's what I fear.
They're super comfortable. The batteries last forever, and they sound great.
We have a deal for you if you want your own pair. If you want to not borrow Scott or I's, and you want your own pair, we've got a deal for you.
If you go to our partners page and click on the Aftershocks banner on the partners tab, you can get a $55 off of the bundle. It's the Trex Air headphones, a multifunction headwear, a pop socket for your phone, and a water bottle.
That's the Trail Runner Nation partners page. You've seen them all over the place, and I certainly have, Scott, more and more lakey poles.
You saw a lot over in Italy, didn't you?
In Italy, I saw plenty, but even over here, they're starting to be more and more because people are understanding they're the best.
If you need a pair of hiking poles, why not buy the best out of the gate? And you can get 20% off, so it's a great value. Go to our partners page and click on the lakey banner, and you can get 20% off. A good pair of lakey trekking poles.
A great pair. Scott, I was on that climb over at Tour de Jeanne, and on the highest peak, on the toughest climb that we're all working through, guess what I saw on a rock sitting there? A broken pole. It wasn't a lakey pole. And the first thing that came to my mind is, man, that guy needs some lakey poles.
Boy, that would totally destroy you emotionally if your pole broke.
If your pole, and you needed these poles for safety. It's just not convenience. Sometimes it's safety. So if you want a set of lakey poles, you want 20% off, use the TRN code 2018. Go to our partners page and link on over.
All the information's on the partners page.
Ladies and gentlemen of the worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true. Frank.
Yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott War, and today is another edition of Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down. I think this is the third.
Okay, yeah, three thumbs. That's about right.
Third edition.
I thought we were going to be done with two, but...
And we have the, as always with a Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, we have very experienced coaches and super fast runners joining us, Ian Sharman, Matt Lay, and Joe Juhan. If you don't know Ian, he's an ultra coach with the USATF and then NASM. He has some certifications there. He set a Grand Slam record back in 2013. And during that Grand Slam record, he actually won the Leadville Trail 100.
And Scott, as always, if maybe this is the first time, as always, I'm going to add another tidbit about Ian. that he holds a 100-mile record PR for the fastest trail time in North America, set at 12 hours and 44 minutes. And that's fast.
That's super fast.
That's on a trail. That's not on a track. That's not with a wind behind you or following some Nike laser beam around a track. This is trail.
Ouch. That was a dig, wasn't it?
They're the road people. We're all right. Who else?
We have Matt Lay, who has joined us also on these Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down. He has a PhD in medical physiology, and he's the assistant professor of health and human performance at the College of Idaho. Do you have something to add?
I do. He has averaged under 8 minute mile for 100 miles, and that's fast. Under eight minute per mile.
That's pretty fast.
I'll draw that on the board for you, Scott.
And lastly, our third coach is Joe Juhan from juhanperformance.com. He's a physical therapist that works in Eugene, Oregon at the Eugene Physical Therapy. And he has a master's degree in kinesiology and a doctorate in physical therapy. He's also a licensed coach. That's why he's on here, because yeah, they're all licensed coaches.
Yeah. And my extra tidbit for Joe Juhan is, Joe, help me out. What extra tidbit could I tell about you? I just know you're a fantastic physical therapist.
One. He has a really cool sprinter van that he drives around in. I don't know
That's
if he lives right. in it, but.
That's right.
Okay, well, there's a tidbit. All right. And I think that you had something to straighten out for us, Ian. I think our computer had a little glitch, and you were about to share something about Matt Lay and records.
Well, you effectively mentioned it with your little extra about him already, which is his sub-8-minute mile, 100-miler, was when he beat me at that same race where I set the record. So he was a good 20 minutes ahead of me there at Rocky Raccoon.
Wow! Any animosity? Any any problems? Friction between you guys?
Only the fact that in the months before, I was doing training runs with him and telling him how to run 100 miles, and then he goes and throws that back in my face by beating me.
Man, Ian, you're a good coach.
Yeah,
he's an excellent coach.
Well, good job. All right, thumbs up, thumb down.
What are the rules?
The rules.
Remind me of the rules, because I get mixed up between all the rules of the.
All the games and all the things. So we invite three very, very smart people, and then we bring you and I, which we have very little knowledge, and we are very impressionable. So the coaches bring up their theory or their thoughts, and the other two coaches discuss it, and they give a thumbs up or thumbs down. Is that something that they subscribe to, believe in, support, or, you know what, kind of sketchy, not so sure that we believe in that, we give it a thumbs down. You and I, of course, we vote, but our votes don't count as full votes. We're just kind of partial votes, like a pinky finger. These guys are thumbs, we're pinkies. So,
okay.
So which coach would like to go first?
Give us a topic.
I'll jump forward. I'll give
All
you
right,
a topic. A very wide-ranging one. Is ultra running unhealthy?
Ah.
Oh, boy. I've read lots of articles about that.
We don't have to have an opinion
and
yet, Scott.
Everyone that I tell that I'm running an ultra says that's unhealthy.
But let's see what the coaches say. Ian, start off with your position, and then we'll let the other two coaches weigh in with thumbs up or down based on your argument, and Scott and I will balance it out somehow.
Well, if we say that thumbs up is that it's healthy, then yeah. I'm going to give it a thumbs up, but there's definitely more to delve into there.
Let's dive. You go. You're
well, basically, you know, there's certainly a lot of damage that's caused the body from running really long races, and particularly 100 milers and at the extreme end of the scale. There's research that's come out showing that really just kind of running 5 miles a day or 5 miles every other day is all you need to get the general health benefits and longevity benefits from running. And that the amount we do with people doing 70, 100, 150 miles a week, crazy amounts of training, that may be marginally detrimental. They've also shown that during a race, your chances of some kind of heart attack are slightly raised. But if you even out the odds of having any kind of medical issue, and particularly heart-related, through your entire life, then the lower chance of having heart defects and other medical conditions when you're not exercising greatly outweighs the slightly increased chance of that happening when you are actually doing really hard efforts. So I would argue that if it's purely about physical well-being, you don't need to run ultras. But running in general, Has benefits beyond just the pure physical. There's the mental well-being. I apologize if my dogs are barking. My wife isn't here, but they just randomly bark every now and then. So basically there's plenty of good reasons physically why some degree of running is good, but maybe not too much. Like most things, your moderation is usually the best perfect thing. But also, if you're going to enjoy running, and that gives you a sense of satisfaction, it gives you a community, it gives you, there's plenty of benefits in terms of reduced depression and other mental disorders, then I would argue, you know, if ultras are the way that allows you to get the most out of that, then it works very well from that perspective. So on balance, I would say ultra running is healthy as long as you can be sensible about it and you don't do things like running through an injury or getting too obsessed.
Very, very good. We're about to hear from the other two coaches and have them weigh in. But this reminds me a lot like two people sitting at a bar having an alcoholic beverage discussing, is alcohol bad for you or not? You know, we've got a very biased group here. We're all runners. Which coach would like to weigh in next?
I'll take the opposite side of things and actually say that I do think that ultra running is unhealthy as a whole. So do we want to discuss or let Joe go ahead and weigh in first?
Okay, Joe, why don't you also another doctor on the staff here? What's your position?
I will say thumbs up. I think it's healthy, and I may steal some of Dr. Lay's thunder and lay out a pharmaceutical term, which is called lethal dose 50 or LD50. And it refers to the volume of any substance that will kill 50% of the population. So every substance on Earth, including water, has an LD50 volume or amount at which if you take too much of this thing, then it's bad for you or will kill you. And I think that certainly for ultra running, and we've seen enough of examples at the high end of if you overdo it, then it's going to be a negative for you. But I think Ian brought up a lot of really good points. And really, you know, you look at some other research things like these blue zone diets, or as you just pointed out, alcohol. You see these correlational studies that say alcohol is correlated with this positive thing, or alcohol or caffeine, as I'm seeing a couple of my gentlemen here drinking caffeine right now. it correlates with good things. But what's hidden in that data is what else is happening in the context of that activity. And you know, for blue zone diets, it has to do, there's elements of culture that play a role in a certain diet being ultimately healthy. It may not be the food, it might be how it's consumed or where. It can be the same thing with your wine, with your coffee. If it's with friends in a social context, it's going to be a great thing for you. And it's the same thing with ultra running. And Ian touched on that if you're spending time in nature, if you're spending time solitude, contemplating, or if you're spending it in a community, it's ultimately going to be a good thing.
All right. So it sounds like we have a two thumbs up and a thumbs down earlier. Matt Lay, you're all by yourself there with your thumbs down. Why did you put thumbs down?
Because, you know, I'm an academic and I have to play the contrarian every once in a while. But also, I mean, I completely agree with a lot of what Joe and Ian have said with regards to the dose is really going to be the thing that determines whether it's a thumbs up or thumbs down. And, you know, is it ultra running? So 50K, or is that what our dose is in terms of what an ultra run is? Or are we talking 50 miles, 100 miles, 200 milers now in terms of what is considered unhealthy? And I just think that even below a 50K race distance, that you can have plenty of benefits that make you healthy. And that going beyond 50K doesn't add anything to the amount of the positive benefits you get from the exercise, the community, which you don't need an ultra to have community, right? You can do that in a park run that's a 5K. And so I think that just saying that more is somehow better in this case is not necessarily true, and that an ultra run is actually perhaps at the point of diminishing returns. That doesn't mean there's not other good reasons to do it. There's plenty of good reasons to do it. We all have to feed our egos in some way sometimes. That's something that I think a lot of us get out of the competition. And I've had to learn with not having an injury myself and not being able to to do that and find other outlets for that. So it serves maybe as a healthy outlet for some unhealthy trends in some ways. But I just think that there are other healthier ways of exercising. They disagree, clearly. Their thumbs. Dean's dogs are definitely thumbs up.
Yeah, they completely agree with you. That's the thing. Yeah, my wife's away, so I have no ability to quieten them when on a call.
You know, I heard two thumbs up, and I heard with Matt, I heard a thumbs down, but a folded thumb. I think he wasn't completely, you know, it was an academic position, taking the other side just for sake of argument. Scott, what do you think? Thumbs up or thumbs down? You've heard some good arguments.
You know, I agree with what Ian said initially, that physically there may be an argument to say that it isn't healthy, but overall, if you take a holistic view of this, whether it's psychological, mental, emotional, I think that absolutely a huge thumbs up. And I will say, you know, I do believe, because I have a lot of friends that don't run, and they're having all sorts of old man syndrome stuff, you know, with, they always say, I can't run, I have bad knees. And I'm saying, you know, I have two reconstructed knees and I'm doing fine. I think it's good for the soft fascia to be out there running. Now, you could argue, could I get the same benefit running 10K versus 50K or 50 mile or 100 mile? But I'm an enthusiastic two thumbs up.
I'm going to go thumbs up too, because the people that I know that run, they're happier. And life's about joy and being happy. So I'm going to go thumbs up. Matt, you're all by yourself on this one, but it's only the first round.
You don't know anyone who doesn't run ultras? Come on. You need to get some new friends.
I'll have to play that back and see what I said exactly.
He doesn't have any other friends.
Yeah, you guys are it right now. I mean, this is it. Everybody on this podcast. All right, so who's up next? All right, Matt, you look like you tilted your head right.
Time training or mileage? So let's say, do you run by the amount of time you do or how many miles you do? And as a coach, do you prescribe by mileage or time? So
are you saying, is it, to put it in a thumbs up or thumbs down, are you saying timed is better than distance? Is that your statement?
Sure, I don't have. Let's go with that. Okay. Time is better than distance.
Okay.
Time is better than distance. Thumbs
time
up.
Is better than distance. Okay. That's your position as a thumbs up from Matt. Time is better than distance. Any other thoughts on that, gentlemen? And then we'll let
you know. I'll throw another variable in there, and this is
we can barely manage two.
Well, no, this is a little other variable, a little caveat, okay. And that's, you know,
caveats are fine
for what you and I have been discussing and the way you trained this year, where you didn't train by either time or distance; it was vertical feet.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to throw that caveat in.
You can, but it kind of complicates the matters here. Okay. Gentlemen, coaches, Joe and to Ian, are you thumbs up on down? What are you, more time as a coach or mileage? And then it'll bounce back to you, Matt, to defend your statement.
All right.
I would say thumbs up to time. And I think you could say that across the board. And I know I will put some a little shout out to my alma mater, University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, Division III school in Wisconsin, who my good friend Dan Schwamberger, I want to say 2 years ago, won the Division III national championship. And a big part of what they did and what he did in shaping that program was really having a nice balance between running really easy and running hard. And what I can speak for, when, especially when I was in a collegiate environment, that, and this applies to ultras too, is there's this tendency to, okay, I'm given X number of miles to run, and there's invariably this race mindset in your brain that says, okay, well, I do this route, I do this loop, I'm going to finish it. And, you know, I get a little extra breather if I finish 2 minutes earlier. So what happens then is you get this kind of seepage from easy to medium, and then sometimes even from into a hard run as a result. So what he's done at Wisconsin Eau Claire is say, okay, well, you're running 50 minutes today. So it de-incentivizes someone pushing harder. They're going to run whatever they ultimately makes them feel good. And as far as ultra running goes, man, that's just so important, because for me as a coach, if I prescribe a certain workout and I'm saying, okay, well, I want this particular trail or this terrain, the amount of time that that's going to take is going to be very different in that overall workload, very different from a run that's flat in a cool environment and non-technical. So, you know, I think I can speak for the three of us coaches and us having a scientific bent that we want to have pay attention to the detail of intensity on every run, and a timed run is the best way to do that.
Very good. Ian?
I'm going to say thumbs up as well. But saying that, I actually use both time and distance depending on the runner. And sometimes a description that involves both. So certainly with ultra running, a lot of what we're doing involves going out into hillier terrain. So we mentioned the idea of vertical targets rather than just time or distance. And if you're getting someone to go out into the mountains, then 4 hours might only be, you know, 12 miles or something like that. So given that, if you tell them to do a long run, they think a long run always means 20 plus miles, then they could be out there for way too long. So it's really just about making sure the workload is balanced. And that means the balance between recovery and harder stimulus as well. And, you know, I personally do a lot of my kind of long runs in the mountains being more like 13, 14 miles. But I'm out there for a good amount of time and there's a huge amount of hiking and it's just very, very slow. So if I were to go out there and do what I think of as a long run when training for a road marathon, I would be out there twice as long, and it just wouldn't be the stimulus that I'm aiming for. So it's really very much about working out for the individual what their workload is, and also that you can't just say for a fast and a slow runner that they should do the same kind of mileage, but they might do the similar kind of amount of time per week. So it's a good way of gauging that and allowing for how fast someone moves. One big caveat to that is that sometimes if I tell someone to do a certain amount of time, they kind of take a little too easy because they know they're going to be out there for a certain number of hours. So they just feel like they've got to fill those hours rather than necessarily pushing as much as they need to. So if there's some degree of time and some degree of distance that they're using to benchmark both of those things, allowing for how fast they are and how hard they should be pushing, that helps to just give them a bit more of a definition of what they're aiming for.
Ian, would you ever use not only time, but say heart rate to keep their intensity up, or do you steer away from that?
I tend to only use heart rate as a way to help guide people to make those internal judgments themselves. So if someone has no idea the difference between easy and hard and they're doing everything kind of in the middle, then I'll say, let's use a heart rate monitor to make sure your easy runs are really easy, your hard runs are really hard, and the long runs are somewhere in the middle of that typically. But I try and get them and wean them away from that so that within a race environment, they're not being forced to use some external device and they have the skill set to judge it themselves. So it's certainly something that can be used as part of it. I'd say it's less important, especially for a long ultra running training run, because the effort level is typically quite low in that anyway. So if they had to hit a certain heart rate, they might actually be doing the effect of a race, which wouldn't necessarily be a suitable effort level.
Professor Lay, this is your topic.
Oh, I just wanted to choose it because I knew they would answer it so beautifully.
Well done.
I mean, the only other thing I would add is that also on shorter interval type things, I think that time is a great way to go, because the physiological adaptations and the stresses that we feel are very much time dependent and not distance dependent. So someone might run mile repeats at 8 minute pace or at 5 minute pace, and those aren't actually the same thing for those two different people. So they may extend out into different sort of systems and anaerobic aerobic systems and things like that. So I think that keeping time, even for some of the intervals, can be beneficial for a variety of athletes, depending on their skill set. So,
coaches, give us three thumbs up. Scott, I'm going to go thumbs up too. I wouldn't dare go against the tide that's pushing thumbs up. But I do like time better, and I wonder if that's something that's evolved recently. I remember, at least in our beginning of running, Scott, back, say, 2002-ish, there was more, we talked more mileage, and now more time. So I don't know if terminology is starting to change and viewpoint, but I do like time much better. What do you think?
Well, a couple things. One is, if you look at training plans out there, it's interesting, and I haven't looked at recent training plans. Maybe they've changed or evolved. But if you look at those, it says this is how many miles you need to run this right. week. This is how many miles you need to run on Mondays and Wednesdays, and how many you need to do on the so they are mileage based. And
that's why you need to hire a coach, Scott, because maybe that's old school.
But I will say I'm also a thumbs up, and the reason why is running these trail ultras, there's a lot of walking that's involved, a lot of power hiking.
We call it hiking.
Yeah. Sorry. I just call it really, really slow running.
Okay.
But I think that it's important for us to do a lot of that in our training, because if you think of a trail race, if you're going out there to do your second or third or first 100-mile race, you know, it may be the last half of the race, that's all you're doing. Hmm. There's no running at all. It may be all power hiking. And so I think it's a good idea I'm thinking that we probably don't do enough power hiking in our training. And so if you're talking about time versus distance, I think that helps aid that. As coaches, do you see that? Do you think that we don't do enough effective power hiking in our training? With form and
I would say definitely. I mean, one of the first changes I tend to make with people when they start working with me is actually doing some form of training for hiking, because most runners don't do it at all. And most ultra runners even don't really consider it either.
Hmm. Okay.
Five thumbs up.
Five thumbs up.
No dissenters.
Joe Yuhan. Dr. Yuhan.
My turn for a topic?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, this is going to be a good one, I think. It may require a little bit of introduction by me.
How about it?
And it is hyperbaric treatment is going to be a better investment than an altitude tent.
Ooh, that's a great topic.
Most runners are fairly familiar with an altitude tent, and an altitude tent or some sort of altitude facility is an artificially created. And the coaches can correct me if I'm omitting or making any errors, but it is a artificially created environment whereby you simulate high altitude conditions. And the idea is that by doing so, your body makes those physiological adaptations similar to living or training at altitude. So the most common, I believe, method to doing that besides living at altitude is to rent or purchase an altitude tent, which basically amounts to this kind of apparatus that goes over your bed and it gets enclosed. And I'm not exactly sure how it's a modification of the gases. I want to say it might be a little bit more nitrogen, but maybe Matt knows.
I think that's right. I think it's they increase the amount of nitrogen to reduce the amount of oxygen.
Yep. So it decreases the amount of oxygen, and the idea is you do with less oxygen, you make these adaptations, more red blood cells and more oxygen carrying capacity and so on. So that's the altitude training. And on the other end, this has been a recent kind of personal experiment for me is hyperbaric treatment. And hyperbaric treatment is the exact opposite, where you get into a vessel that is pressurized at 1.3 atmospheres. So it is about 30% more pressurized than just regular, I guess, sea level. And they say, to not scare you, it's like, well, this is about the same as if you were 12 feet underwater. So you get in this chamber that's pressurized, and then you have a nasal cannula with oxygen, and you lay there and breathe oxygen and relax for 60 to 90 minutes. So the hyperbarics is a medical treatment, and there's a variety of different treatments that is actually prescribed and paid for by insurance. Certain conditions, whether it's poor wound healing or certain diabetic ulcers or things like that, because they found that concentrated oxygen aids healing. So that's the idea then is whether you are someone who's ill or then on the other end an athlete training hard, that in the process of being in the hyperbaric chamber, you're not only do you get this oxygen uptake, but the increased pressure forces the dissolution of oxygen into the intercellular fluid. So just like the little bits of water and stuff that's floating around between cells and other parts of your tissues, it more or less jams oxygen in there. And in doing so, it you get perfusion of oxygen that's more effective than, okay, just let's just say you go to a yoga class and breathe and the blood pumps the oxygen as it's supposed to. So it's an interesting idea, and I'm not sure at this point, maybe I should not reveal my hand in terms of my opinion and have the guys weigh in. What do you guys think we should do?
Yeah, I think that sounds great.
I have a clarification.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand. So the hyperbaric treatment increases the O2?
Yes.
So for altitude training, it would do the opposite?
Correct.
Because you're increasing. So does the hyperbaric treatment help in training for altitude distances?
It does not.
I don't know
not.
If I understand
no.
that. Okay.
So that's a good clarification. So the motivation to do altitude, to do an altitude tent would be we want to, physiologically create the adaptation so the body gets used to not enough oxygen, so it increases its carrying capacity. But I also think that there is a neurological or a mental aspect too, where your body also gets used to functioning at that sort of a altitude slash partial pressure of oxygen, as it were. On the tail end, what hyperbaric treatment is it is a recovery technique with the idea that, okay, you've absent of an injury, or let's just say that it's not even an injury, but you're just training hard, that increased uptake in oxygen is going to facilitate faster recovery. And then that extra layer would be, I have some aches and pains, and a good way to facilitate, speed up that healing is that enhanced additional oxygen. So it's two different things. My thumbs up or versus thumbs down assertion is...
Hide your thumbs for a second, Joe.
I'm not revealing my hand per se.
Okay, good.
But
okay.
My statement is for the average ultra runner, hyperbaric treatment is a better use of their time and money than an altitude tent.
Okay, got it. Okay. Well stated. Who would like to take that on first, Matt or Ian?
I'd like to hear Matt's thoughts first.
So I'm going to say thumbs up that the hyperbaric is going to be a better bet for your money than the hypoxic chambers. And with the caveat that if you're competing at anything other than altitude, right? So if you're, I don't think there's probably much of a dispute that if you're competing at high altitude, you don't live at high altitude, you need some sort of altitude stimulus. That's going to give you a better hand to play at altitude. If you're talking about at sea level, then I don't think that hypoxic chambers are going to be that effective. And the data that I see out of the hyperbaric stuff is promising, but still very new. And I think that the theory makes a lot of sense, that if you sit in you need a recovered state, so you need maybe more oxygen to get to the tissues, that hyperbaric chamber is going to provide that opportunity for that to happen. And I just don't think that the hypoxic stimulus is great enough for most of us at sea level to give you much of a benefit. So,
good answer. Ian, would you like to weigh in, or you think we've covered that?
No, I definitely got something to add then. I'd say thumbs up, but with the caveat that I'm not that familiar with the hyperbaric chamber and the benefits of additional oxygen for speeding recovery. From the perspective of most ultra runs, it's more about getting better at running at altitude because we do mountain races. And from that perspective, I think anything that speeds your recovery is good. And so the hyperbaric side of things may be more useful there. The hypoxic tents, where it's just reducing the amount of oxygen volume that you're breathing, but it's not changing the pressure. So it's not all of the effects you get of being at high altitude where you have lower pressure too. From what I gather, you need to be in a tent for such a long period of time per day and for several weeks for it to really make much of a difference. So typically, if you're just sleeping 8 hours a night and it doesn't have any change in pressure, it's going to be very minimal effect. Probably better than nothing, but very minimal. And I'd always advise people to actually just go up to altitude for a week before the race and make it a vacation instead, because that's going to be a much stronger stimulus. If we're talking about just general fitness and health, then the altitude tent will have very little benefit there. It's not, you know, maybe it'll give you a few extra red blood cells for sleeping in it overnight, but also you may lose some quality of recovery because I've used one before. It's quite hot and sweaty. It's not as pleasant. I didn't sleep as well. If it has any effect on reducing your quality of sleep, then that's quite a serious detrimental element to your training if you can't recover as well. So I would say for all the perspectives, either running and racing at a high altitude or just general running at low altitude as well, if something helps recovery, i.e. the hyperbaric chamber, then that's more useful than something that has a very marginal benefit to being at altitude. So that would be my answer, but it definitely a few caveats in there. And I'm not that familiar with the hyperbaric side of things and increased oxygen, but I will get more familiar because my local gym in Bend, Recharge, are going to be making a hyperbaric chamber where they will do exactly that, where they can change the pressure and give you loads of extra oxygen or less for various types of training.
You know, I want to ask a question as long as you just stated that at the end, Ian. Is the hyperbaric chamber or therapy, does that need to be done at a clinic, someplace that has this room or coffin, if you will?
Imagine they're expensive.
You can't necessarily rent one like you can do a hypoxic tent. Is that correct?
I'm not aware, but I think it's generally a room. So I don't think you can rent a room that easily in your own house. But there may be other stuff available now. I don't know.
They are rentable. I mean, they're expensive at this point. But so that is an interesting. And to be honest, it's probably on par with a hypoxico unit. I mean, they're both pretty darn pricey, but you can actually get your own unit for home use.
And is it like a coffin? Because presumably you can't seal off an entire room.
It's I call it the giant hot dog. It's just like this kind of tube that you get inside and you zip up and you just lay there. So it certainly is a lot more convenient than having to kind of wall off of a room or a bed. But again, yeah, that's getting into the difference of usage to the 60 to 90 minutes versus as much time as you possibly can.
Hey, Joe, before we get your opinion, thumbs up or thumbs down, have you used one of these? It sounds like you have some experience.
Yeah, so I've been using one. I just started this month. It's been a very interesting ride for me in the last year. I got Giardia on a trail run about a year and a half ago. And in the process, my GI system got really messed up, both from that infection and then the treatment. And then treating it, it's much better, but I've gotten significant adrenal fatigue. Some really, really interesting stuff. So I sought it out as a way to facilitate just kind of my overall kind of health and wellness. So it's been a very interesting process now, having done it, you know, for the last month. And it certainly shows a lot of promise. So, it's a very interesting idea, to say the least.
Good. So I'm assuming you're a thumbs up on this, Joe.
So yeah, if you're ready for my ruling, it is a thumbs up. And I think it's kind of echoing the same stance that both Matt and Ian are, is it's a contrast. So I get a lot of questions as a coach and from other ultra runners about altitude tents, and you have to take whatever modality or whatever choice that you're making, it's an opportunity cost. And Ian really hit the nail on the head when he said it's not worth doing if it's a major disruptor to other aspects of your life. And And, you know, one of the big drawbacks potentially for an altitude tent, even if you have a high altitude race, is they can be really uncomfortable. So you've got this thing, it's trapping all the moisture, all of the heat. And my goodness, if you are married or have a partner and you're forcing that person to get in there. And I, you know, as a recent newlywed, I mean, we have to keep our room, gosh, at, you know, 55 degrees when the two of us are in there. So it's robbing Peter to pay Paul, if not more so, when you're in a situation that here's this thing that can offer a finite gain, but it could have an infinite cost if it's, you know, if it's a detriment to your sleep. So that's my big knock against altitude tents. And then on the flip side, you look at something like hyperbaric treatment, and I look at it as, okay, well, here's this thing. It's the physiology makes sense to me. And like Matt said, that there's some studies, but it's pretty early on. But the physiology makes sense. And then you can look at almost any other modality. Like we were talking about this, these correlational studies, you could say, okay, well, icing or drinking coffee or having a glass of wine or all these other things that we do for either pleasure or health, if it's going to enhance relaxation, it's going to be a net positive. So when I go to the hyperbaric chamber and climb inside my plastic hot dog and lay there for an hour and either nap or read a book, I know that in the very least that that's going to be a good thing for me. And we'll just hope then that the added value of the pressurized oxygen is going to be the lion's share of that. But I'm not going there worrying that, oh crap, you know, I'm not sleeping at night and it's super hot and I'm going to gut this out because I have to train for some race at altitude. So I think it's something I'm going to continue to monitor, and we may talk at a subsequent discussion here about hyperbarics and either my personal or coaching experience, but it's certainly an interesting idea.
Where does one find a hyperbaric?
Google.
Okay.
It's there.
It doesn't, I kind of chuckle a little bit. It doesn't surprise me at all that an outfit like Recharge or some of these recovery lounge operations, such as the one in Bend that Ian's referring to, is going into this. Because I think it's catching on. People are liking the idea, and it's right. It's in the same kind of modality as the compression boots or infrared saunas. All these things that are showing promise for recovery and rejuvenation. So they're popping up, and I would say on the West Coast that they are that they're increasingly numerous.
You know what occurred to me, Joe, as you were listing those things, recovery boots, infrared sauna, this hyperbaric chamber, or even the altitude tent, all of these things involve staying still for a while, laying down, and just relaxing. And exactly. What, you know, that'd be a great a study. You know, just have some people in a placebo type, just lay down for a while. There's a lot of benefit in rest. And as busy people, we usually don't rest until we're asleep. You know, we're go-go-goes.
Yeah.
So I had the chance to use a piece of hypoxico equipment from Dylan Bowman's company, and I agree with many of the things that were stated. I agree that it does get a bit hot and muggy in there. And what's cool is they don't necessarily have a full tent over the bed, which is offered. They also have a head tent. So just your torso is underneath, which spares the rest of your body, which is good. So it's not quite as hot. So that's a nice add. I also noticed that what you talked about, robbing Peter to pay Paul, your sleep is not as sound. And so the benefit maybe of resting there and not resting completely may offset the benefit. However, I think that I was able to use the mask and train on a stationary piece of equipment. I think putting the body under load while using that there's benefit there. So I give two thumbs up to using a piece of equipment, a hypoxico piece of equipment on something stationary, making your body work with less oxygen, I think good. However, getting in that hyperbaric chamber and just resting and recovering. I think that's a great ad, especially if you're a person that doesn't get altitude sickness. If you were going to race something at 10,000 feet, you never have trouble at 10,000 feet, well, you're probably okay. Invest in the other one. I think if historically you fail miserably with all the altitude sickness at 10,000 feet, you better get yourself in a spot where you can eliminate that risk. So those are my opinions.
Or per Ian's comment,
yeah,
take a little bit of vacation time and just go live at that altitude for a week or
yeah,
two.
The advice I always give people when they say they want me to train them for Leadville is, okay, can you spare at least 1 week of vacation? It's a fun place to go. Hang out in Colorado, just somewhere at high altitude. And if they can't and they want to rely purely on something like an altitude tent, then I tell them that the odds of finishing are significantly lower, that they won't be as good as having nonstop time. It's not like many things where when you train, you just need a stimulus for like an hour. You do a speed session, then your body reacts afterwards. With altitude, it's about time at altitude. So if you don't get enough time over a number of weeks of your body mainly being in that environment, then you don't get many benefits from it.
Ian, I want to ask you a question about that. So you recommend going out there a week before the race.
At the minimum, I'd actually say if you can do 2 to 3, that would be, depending on, you know, most people don't have 2 to 3 weeks spare, but I tell them 1 week minimum if they want to seriously consider the race. And if that doesn't fit in, then maybe do it another year. If they're still wanting to do it, then we look at other options like altitude tents. But realistically, I tell them that's the thing that'll, it doesn't matter how fit they get, if the altitude gets them going over the high parts of a race, then there's only so much you can prepare your body for it without being up there.
My question is, you're making this recommendation to go out there. If they're out there a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the race, they probably, and they're sleeping at altitude, they're not getting that restful sleep right before the race. Is that, I guess that is offset by the gains that they're getting at increasing those red blood cells versus a real restful night's sleep of recovery.
But it'll also get better after they've been there for a few nights once they've started adapting. So once they've been there about a week, their level of recovery will be better. But there's two reasons why 2 to 3 weeks is what I advise. Is firstly, if it's longer than that, it's difficult for them to do hard training and still get recovery. And if it's shorter than that, then they're not getting enough altitude adaptation. But 2 to 3 weeks is about the sweet spot where you get most of the altitude adaptation, and it's the taper anyway, so you don't need to be doing really hard training.
Very good.
I've got one follow-up question on this topic before we move on, and maybe it's a question for Dr. Lay. I had heard that when it comes to altitude acclimatization, that you're almost better off on the extremes, that if you can't do 2 to 4 weeks, you're better off doing none. And my interpretation of that recommendation was that if you're there like 2 to 7 days, your body is fatigued out in that initial adaptation phase. Do you know anything about that idea? Am I wrong, or what have you heard in that realm?
Well, when I learned about this as an undergrad, and it was like the first physiology class I actually took, I went to my professor because I was thinking about running at altitude, and I went to the professor and said, should I go to altitude and train? And he said, Dr. Adams was like, you should take my class instead and figure out if you should train at altitude for yourself. So very wise UC Davis professor. And so I took the class, I switched my major. And so that was some of the first stuff that I learned about. And I actually have not followed it tremendously. But what I remember from then is that one of the first changes that happens to your body when you go to altitude is because when you go up to altitude, the pressure is less, right? And one of the first things you lose is actually blood volume because there's less atmospheric pressure pushing on your entire body, including your circulatory system. So you start to lose blood volume. And that adaptation occurs within that 2 to 5 day window, which is why they think that you should either be going up immediately before the event or 2 to 3 weeks after, where you have a little bit of time to normalize and sort of overcome some of the initial, that initial shock to the less barometric pressure at altitude. So that is what I've heard as well. I honestly haven't seen that much science or data to back that assertion up. But what I recommend for my athletes is I would recommend the same thing, either get there right before or spend 2 to 3 weeks.
And I'd add a little bit of nuance to that. Just the science behind it is summarized well in Professor Tim Noakes' Law of Running, where he's basically saying, yeah, that between about 1 to 6 days, your body is just adapting. So if you can only get there 5 days in advance, it's better often to turn up right before, so literally the day of the race. There does seem to be more difficulty doing that the longer the race is. I've seen people who seem fine doing the Leadville Marathon, the Leadville 50 miler, where they turn up the day before, but then the 100 mile of the altitude gets them doing that. So I would say that the cumulative amount of time exercising at altitude, and time, not distance, being the important thing there, is very important. So the longer the race is, the more important it is to have good altitude adaptation, as opposed to just turning up and not having the negative side effects of being at altitude. But because it is that kind of 2 to 6 day period, 1 to 6 day period where you're going to feel worse, that's why I say 1 week minimum. By that, I mean 7 days. If they think they can turn up on the Sunday for the next Saturday, I'm telling them even that's not ideal. It's 7 days minimum. And that's why I prefer 2 to 3 weeks.
That's an interesting implication for just a ton of ultra runners. You know, you think about what the average Western States runner does, and it may not be the best example of super high altitude, but it's still relevant. Most people show up on Wednesday or Thursday. And I've noticed that myself, by the time Saturday morning or Friday night comes around, I'm not feeling very well. So that's kind of in my plans for myself the next time I run Western States, that I'm either getting there way early or I'm going to drive up from the valley on Friday morning.
Have any of you seen articles about supporting either its usefulness or not with the altitude training? Shouldn't we be able to measure how the count of red blood cells in our volume of blood, shouldn't we be able to compare and contrast and do a real hard study whether it works or not? Has anybody seen anything in the research?
Well, that's what Tim Noakes' stuff is summarizing, basically, yeah. And that's why it's the 2 to 6 days where it gets worse.
Okay.
And where the red blood cells, the benefit of getting more of them is outweighing the negative effects of feeling tired. So that is very much science-based rather than anecdotal.
And the half-life of red blood cells is more in the 8-week range than the 2 to 3 week range. So it's going to take a significant amount of time before you actually turn over all of your red blood cells. And if you talk to people who go up to altitude for a while, they'll get this secondary bump that's several months in where they start to feel even better than that initial 2 to 3 week time period as well. And that's probably related more to the red blood cell mass than anything.
Nice. Now, Scott, we've had three topics. We're at about 48 minutes, which means we're getting better at picking topics, right? Because they're interesting, people discuss them, and that's really what this is about, which means you and I, we're going to have to do rapid fire round on ours, okay?
That'll be easy for mine because mine is not a good topic.
And well, mine's pretty simple too. So we're going to kind of bring it down. So the IQ requirement earlier on in this podcast was quite high. Now you can relax. You can take it easy because here's my topic.
Okay.
And it comes from actually Ultra Running Magazine. And I'd like to credit Pam Smith, who we all know has won Western States in 2013. And she's run over 70 ultras and a fantastic ambassador to the sport. And she has the topic, bladders versus bottles. And one of the things I noticed when we entered the sport, everybody carried bottles. I mean, you carried bottles. Nobody carried a pack unless it was a waste pack. And then it evolved to all these vests and hydration packs. So I'm going to throw it out there. Guys, bottles or bladders?
Well, that's not a thumbs up, thumbs down. You got to take a stand.
Oh,
Freeman.
I forgot.
You got to take a stand.
Yeah, I made this thing up. Okay. I'm going to say thumbs up. And I'm going to share why.
What's the statement? Are you saying bladders are better than bottles?
Oh, okay. Okay, here's the statement.
You need to make a statement.
Thank you. Okay.
Take a position.
All right. And you can bet this will be edited. Not. It'll be just like it is here. Okay. I think bottles are better than hydration bladders. I think I think bottles are better than bladders. Thumbs up to bottles.
Okay.
Is that clear enough, Scott?
Yeah, that's clear. Thank
okay.
you.
Why don't you follow up, and we'll spare the coaches for a second. Go ahead.
You know,
what's your opinion?
I am also a thumbs up. For some reason, I would rather not run with something on my back. I like to sweat a lot. And it seems constraining. I feel like I have a heater on my back. So I'm thumbs up with bottles.
And remember, just as part of this discussion, you can carry bottles in your vest.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Coaches, bottles, I give a thumbs up. Scott gives a thumbs up for bottles. What about you? And we have photos. We can search. We can see what you do.
I'll explain what. So I say thumbs up because it depends on the race, though. But bottles are a little bit easier to manage, you know, when your liquid's running out. And particularly if it's a hot run, you can fill it up with ice and water, and then you can pour it on your head, which you can't do if you've got a bladder because it won't pour out of there. But if you're doing a longer event and you've got to carry more liquids, then I would say a bladder is usually going to be a better option. And you know, if there's bigger gaps between aid stations or you're having to get it naturally from water streams and things like that, then but I personally prefer bottles as the default unless there's a need to carry a lot more.
Good. Either way, Matt, I see you shaking your head. What's your thought?
I'm with bottles as well, just because you can manage your fluid intake a lot easier.
And Joe?
Thumbs up on bottles. And
yeah,
it's almost, it's more about the implications of the bladder. I was working an aid station at Waldo 100K this year, and a guy who was pacing another runner. It was a 70-degree day. It was sunny. You know, it was getting kind of warm. This guy took 100 ounces of water. Like, he filled his bladder with, like, a gallon of water. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, A, please don't die of hyponatremia on the trail. But B, I wrote an article in Ultra Running a few years ago that talked about the biomechanical implications of and maybe that's what Pam was getting at too. I didn't see this article, but the biomechanical implications of gear and the pack becomes this gateway to more is better. So you'll see pictures of me with a pack, but it might have 40 ounces of water in it. The problem with these higher volume packs is that we think we need more and more stuff, and besides the weight, a pack can cause excessive flexion in the thoracic spine, which decreases a couple of really important things. Number one, if you are flexed in your thoracic spine or in your spine in general, it decreases hip extension. And hip extension is the gold standard of propulsion or running speed and efficiency. So seldom do people realize that you wear a pack, you're slowing yourself down biomechanically. And the other aspect is it can decrease breathing volume. And that's a huge factor. Thoracic flexion or just the tightness of a pack, especially one weighted with 100 ounces of water, can have an enormous effect on breathing and again, on propulsion. So the thumbs ups for the bottle, just because for everything the guy's already said, but you're putting a max on the amount of stuff that you're putting onto your frame.
Now, this was, if you want to go back and reference it, or any of the listeners in their Ultra Running magazine, it was July's issue, and she breaks it down. She does real well with a Western State University in Colorado. They did a study showing that carrying extra weight centrally was more efficient in terms of VO2 max and oxygen utilization. Yet, when we carry these bottles, for me, I'm more apt to drink. I don't drink if I have a bladder on my back. I just don't put the effort in. It's not worth it, but I can chug down a half a bottle pretty easy on the fly. So I'm definitely going to use the bottle.
I'm going to add a subset of your thumbs up, thumbs down question, and very little explanation is needed, but the recent advent of the Soft Flex handheld bottles.
Yeah.
Thumbs up or thumbs down? Soft Flex versus the old
standard.
Ultimate Direction fast draw bottle. You like the Soft Flex?
I'm kind of thumbs down, mainly because they're not as big. So I think they work better if you're having a backpack. So if you're doing something like UTMB where you have to carry a load of gear and therefore, and maybe poles as well, then having bottles in the front, I'd rather have a soft gel bottle than a hard one at the front of my pack. But for the same reason that I like bottles in general over a hydration pack, I'd rather have a slightly larger carrying capacity. So the 20-ounce bottles are ideal. And also some of those smaller, softer ones, the size of the opening is too small to fit ice in. So it's just really awkward in an aid station trying to actually fill it up with anything and maybe doesn't allow anything in there at all in terms of ice cubes.
How about you, Matt?
I'll go thumbs down because I like to actually, the handhelds, I like to fall on it. So, you know.
It's airbag effect. Airbag effect. I agree with you there. How about you, Joe?
It is a measured thumbs up. I think it's the same as what Ian said. I think they're great if you have something to put them in, but it's like one of those water balloon toys when you were a kid where you like squeeze it and it pops out of your hand. If you're trying to carry one of those soft bottles without any other, just plainly in your hand, it's pretty tough.
I've blown those up like a balloon and blow air into it, and then it's rigid hard. But then you've got to listen to the sloshing, and I don't like listening to slosh.
I like the idea of a soft flex bottle, but it's hard for me to get the thing full of water.
Well,
and you fill it up, and then you have to like look at it, and you kind of blow in it and expand it a little bit, and then you fill it up again, and it's.
Yeah. Scott, you literally have 3 minutes.
Here is mine. It's very easy. Thumbs up or thumbs down. It has to do with plantar fasciitis. And
we can do that in 3 minutes.
recovery and recovery. Stretching. Here's the thumbs up or thumbs down. Because there's two sides of the story. Some people say you should stretch and you know, get a roller and you roll your foot. Some people say you shouldn't do anything. So my thumbs up or thumbs down is stretching and rolling is good for plantar fasciitis recovery.
I'm going to go thumb. I'm just going to weigh in because we're on this side of the table, yeah. the guessers. I'm going to say thumbs up. I think you need to do something to manage it. And stretching by definition, don't overstretch. Stretch just enough. So put that in the equation of just enough foam rolling and stretching to be efficient and not be counterproductive. I'm going to point finger over to Joe Yuhan, who has his PhD, a doctorate in PhD, and not PhD, in PT, physical therapy. Joe, what do you think?
I'm going to be controversial here and say thumbs down. And for me at Yuhan Performance, and by the way, Yuhan Performance is my own PT clinic that's been open for 2.5 years in Eugene. I treat what I call four dimensions of care. So there's four things that you have to look at for any injury. One of them is mobility. The next is stability, efficiency, and pacing. Pacing having to do with the amount of load you're putting on a tissue versus what it can do. So yes, mobility is important, but what happens for a lot of people with plantar fasciitis, they're like, oh, I have foot pain, so I'm gonna roll the hell out of my foot. So they almost always overdo it, or they do it when the foot is still in an acute state. So if you have something, by definition, a sprain or a strain is an overstretching. So for something overstretched, you want to, if anything, not stretch it and leave it as is, and instead devote your time to those other areas. Is it strong enough? What's running or walking efficiency like? And then the big one of plantar fasciitis is, what you know, how much load are you putting in it through walking, running, standing in life versus what it can handle? So it's a complicated thumbs down, but because that's only one part of the big scheme.
That's what I meant. I meant to say those things. And my point of reference for
what was it you said at the very beginning of the podcast? We're very impressionable.
Yes. Matt or Ian, would you like to add to the conversation there? Not that we're impressionable about.
I'm not going to disagree with Matt. Joe.
No, I'm not either.
Matt's a smart guy.
I would exactly the way Joe put it there, that it can be useful at certain stages. Ultimately, the whole principle of any kind of advice that anyone gives in any profession is don't give advice about stuff that you're not an expert in. So with something like that, it would need to be diagnosed. Someone physically needs to be examining who has the right skill set, and it's their advice that I'd go with. My default would usually be if there's just the first first hint of it, yeah, do some rolling. Or if the PT or the doctor has said this is okay to do, then do some rolling and stretching, but not just in all blanket cases.
Gosh, guys, this has been a lot of fun. I have other topics. I'd love to do this again. KT tape or rock tape. Is it good or not? There's a ton of places to go with the cast that we have here.
The good thing is we're not limited on the number of podcasts we can do.
Yes, we quite somewhat we are.
We're not. Oh.
Gentlemen, where can we find you? And let's start with you, Matt. You're a professor there at
in Boise.
Yeah, you can find me in Idaho or on Twitter at MJLAYE. You can follow me there and connect. So,
are you doing some active coaching right now?
I have a few athletes, and then I'm actually coaching a team in Boise, the Boise Billies, and we do anything from short road stuff to we have a 100-miler in the group as well. So that's been a lot of fun.
Awesome. How about you, Ian?
At sharmanultra.com, so that's SHARMAN, or at any of the social media stuff is Sharmanian. And basically, you know, there's myself and a whole team of other superstar coaches I've got. So just get in touch if you're interested.
And you do have some superstars that are working with you. How about you, Joe Uhan?
You can find me and my physical therapy, coaching and remote online running stride analysis services at uhanperformance.com.
And if somebody was interested in the running stride, what do they do? Do they send you a video? How do you interact with that as we close out here?
Yeah, pretty simple. We take front and back and side views of your running stride in combination with any issues that you're having, performance issues, aches and pains issues, and we just triangulate and pinpoint those things in your stride that you can improve. And then we give you a full report and some real tools to make positive changes.
Do you also do walking gait analysis? We talked about hiking. Hiking gait analysis.
I can't say I've done that before. I do that clinically very frequently as part of treatment. And I do. There's a couple articles on Iron Far that I've written talking about hiking form and quad preservation. So those you can check those out at my column Stay the Course on ironfar.com.
Very good, guys. Thank you so much for contributing and weighing in on these different topics. We've all learned a lot. I know Scott and I have. We appreciate it. So go out and run.
Awesome.